Science has learned that all people possess mental powers which pass the boundaries of the natural.
Ghosts, Bigfoot, extraterrestrials,
Terra Hub Radio,
psychics, parapsychology, Loch Ness Monster,
Terra Hub Radio,
paranormal news, giveaways, open chat,
Terra Hub Radio,
classic rock, and paranormal talk, Thursdays, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, at parahub.org, bounceradio.net, and beastradio.com.
Shadow governments, strange rituals, new world
shadow
order,
governments, strange
buried treasure,
new
planetary
world
mind control,
strange
military
planetary
cover up,
corporate shadow governments, strange rituals, new world order, buried treasure, planetary mind control,
military
mind
corporate
presidential
assassination,
Out there. It's a strange world.
Visit outthereradio.net for more information.
Interested in ghosts, UFOs? How about the occult? Are you psychic? Would you like to find out? Well, if you're intrigued by the world's curiosities and all that is paranormal, then Paralore.com is a place for you. Create your own profile, start a photo album, write a blog, or just hang out and watch countless hours worth of paranormal videos while chatting with other Paralore members. Who knows? You could win a prize or two if you're quick and brave enough. It's all here, and it's all free. Visit www.paralore.com and join today. Again, membership is free, and we know you won't be disappointed.
Paralore.com. Unlock your mind.
You're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Former Air Force intelligence officer William Van Stecker was driven to seek the truth through a lifetime of thought and study. A UFO abductee, his repeated paranormal experiences and encounters with the sinister former members of the secret elite UFO crash retrieval unit left him with no other option. The conclusions he reached will shock and even outrage you. And I know I like to be outraged.
Makes for great radio.
Oh, it does. So Ghost of Tuck would like to welcome Ben Stecker to the show. Welcome, Ben.
Well, thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you here, and you go by Ben. I forgot to mention that, Doug. You go by Ben. We're going to refer to you as Ben, correct?
Right. William B. Stecker and middle name Benjamin go by Ben.
Okay, fan.
I like that. Okay.
The Atlantis Conspiracy is the book. Basically, you know, you've done a lot of articles also. I mean, is this your first book?
Yeah, it's probably the only book I'll write, although I've got just no end of ideas for articles, mostly on online sites. I mostly write. I have an article in the latest issue of Atlantis Rising, full article, Cities of the Deep, and a letter to the editor. And I've had a couple of short articles and several letters in Fate magazine. But mostly, I'm on these sites that function as online magazines. And I've got over 40 articles at present. I'm on over 30 sites.
Wow, that is absolutely incredible.
Do
people who read them? Because I know I read a lot on the internet, but I rarely write to the author. So, I'm not an email kind of person, but I rarely write and say things. But do people contact you about your articles and say, "Oh my gosh, that just really opened my eyes," or "Thank you so much," or like has online become a lot more interactive than publishing something in a print magazine?
Well, what they can do on some of these sites, like. A lot of my articles, I originally posted to the Unexplained-Mysteries, unexplained-mysteries.com site.
Oh, yeah.
And then other sites will pick it up, and they'll just post it to their sites as well. And if I write something on Unexplained Mysteries site, people will write in comments immediately, directly to the site, which I can read. Very often, they're hostile or negative comments. But, you know, you can't stand the heat. Stay out of the kitchen.
Yeah,
true,
you know,
true.
If you want to be outrageous and controversial and you have strong opinions, you're gonna excite and please some people and you're going to anger some people. And that's their right. They can be critical if they want. It doesn't bother me.
Well, what?
So I get all kinds of comments.
Concerning the Atlantis conspiracy, then, I mean, what is all that commotion about then? What's the idea? What's going on? Why would people be so upset about the Atlantis conspiracy?
Well, not that many people have read The Atlantis Conspiracy. It's never sold very well. Of the people I know who bought the book, people I actually know, a lot of them haven't read it. They'll buy it and not read it, which is kind of strange to me. I mean, if you spend the money on something. Of the ones who have read it, the majority did like it, but a few didn't. I've noticed that there's several groups of people that tend not to like the book. One group being the real knee-jerk, extreme, skeptic-type, debunker types.
Mm.
And the second group being extreme left-wingers, people who like Clinton. I wrote the book during the Clinton regime, and had some unpleasant things to say about him. And the third group, interestingly enough, are some, but not all, fundamentalist Christians. Now, I've come around gradually to believing in some kind of a supreme being. and an actual being, a divine person of some sort, mm-hmm. but I don't belong to any established or conventional religion. I respect Christians and religious Jews both a great deal, but I'm not one, and some of them have taken offense at that. But like I say, you can't please everybody, and there's no point even trying.
Sounds like an
you just
internet
have to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Tell the truth as you see it.
It sure sounds like an internet radio show, then, in that light. You just can't please everybody.
No, yeah, we've been dealing with that for years here. It's way worse.
You must have written the book, and obviously you're churning out ideas. You said ideas for online articles and print magazine articles, but you must have written the book for a reason.
Well, there's a whole lot of reasons. You know, there's a lot of things that in a lifetime of experiences and thought and study and so on that go to making you into the person you are and giving you your set of beliefs and making you think certain things are important and need to be said. But certainly that series of really horrible experiences that began with the encounter abduction experience, that is unique in my life. I don't know if anyone else has been through exactly the same thing. And it was pretty horrible. It just nearly destroyed me. But in the end, it taught me some things.
Well, before, because I do want to hear about that, but before, I want to know, what was your frame of mind? Because, I mean, it says Air Force Intelligence Officer, right? This is what you were. So what did you think of aliens and UFOs and all this fringe stuff that I dabble with, or I sort of immerse myself in every day, but, I talk about every weekend. What did you think of all this stuff? Before your encounter?
Well, my encounter happened the first one when I was only 11 years old.
Ah, okay.
And at that time, I was already interested in UFOs and in human origins and prehistory and lost civilizations and things of that sort. So the experience, I think, tended to reinforce certain interests and certain attitudes you already had.
Well, that actually gives you points with me because that means you're just... You're very similar to how I grew up. I was always interested in this stuff. And and although I didn't have any terrifying experiences like you have, which we'll hear about, I just continued. I mean, it just kept, building and building. And then eventually I found myself surrounded by a whole bunch of friends who were interested in the same thing. And there you go. That's my story in a nutshell. But it actually brings you more to a kind of person that I would talk to and hang out with and know, but I'm always interested in those folks who I had no clue that, I mean, I knew people were talking about aliens and UFOs, I knew people were talking about ghosts, I knew people were talking about that, and I've heard stories here and there, but never thought about it. And then all of a sudden, bam, my whole world changed. That's exciting, too, So either way, it's all good. But so I think I can relate to you, Ben. Let's relate. I want to know your story. What happened when you were 11?
Okay. The experience I had resembled in many, though not in all regards, but in many contemporary accounts of so-called UFO abductions. Now, this whole abduction thing, in one form or another, has been going on since time began. People believe they were abducted by witches, demons, angels, fairies, elves, whatnot. And I suspect maybe our ancestors were a little closer to the truth and really a little more sophisticated in their understanding than we are today with our atheist materialist mindset, assuming it's always nuts and bolts, spacecraft, and aliens.
Right.
Now, I was 11 years old, and I was attending a school-sponsored summer camp at Garner State Park in the Texas Hill Country, I would say very roughly perhaps 100 miles or so west or southwest of San Antonio. And we boys slept on cots and tents, furnishing our own bedding, in my case a thick but summer cotton sleeping bag. My cot at the front of a tent, perhaps the third or fourth down from the end of a row, roughly paralleling the Frio River.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond the last tent was, 100 or 200 yards of partly open, partly wooded countryside, then a fence running down to the river, and then more countryside, not true wilderness, but pretty much deserted, riding and hiking trails, the state park, deserted in the witching hours. And I went to sleep one night, and all seemed well, and then everything changed forever. There would be no going back. I didn't ask for this, but I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I found myself with no sense of transition, no sense of how I came to be there, standing way out in the dark, starry, moonless night, barefoot, sleeping bag slung over my shoulder by the fence, a long way from camp. And I was in the strangest state of consciousness. I've never experienced anything like this since or before. I was utterly unafraid, absolutely calm. It wasn't like a dream. It wasn't like being half awake. It wasn't like what we think of as being awake. I don't think we really are. It was different. I was just absolutely unafraid when I should have been terrified, and I was totally calm. I'm reminded of the Buddhist phrase, the peace of the past with understanding. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I'm not like that. I'm a type A, hubba hubba go go personality. You know, multitasking and screwing it all up most of the time.
Oh,
yeah. Very impatient, often angry and judgmental. But that night I was calm, and I was not alone. More or less surrounding me, so far as I could see, were several individuals. Now, I've never been able to remember exactly what they looked like, and I want to mention right now that at no time do I recall any invasive procedures or any evidence of such later, none of that usual stuff, nor do I recall ever seeing a UFO or being in a lighted interior, just me and these beings in the dark, starry night. Mm-hmm. And they were either fully human are, and I hesitate to use this term with all that it implies, humanoid mm-hmm. in appearance. I don't think they were from another planet. They might have been. I'm leaning more toward the paranormal point of view, like the late John Keel believed in, Jacques Vallée and others.
Right.
Or they could have been fully human, albeit, as we should see, they would have had to have had some rather remarkable powers. Now, no words were spoken, not even a voice in my head, but I had a powerful sense of being questioned or interrogated. And now, years later, now I'm also quite certain they imparted to me some knowledge or teaching. Now, you don't go to an 11-year-old boy in 1955, and say, hey, kid, here's all the secrets of the universe.
Yeah.
You know, I would not have understood nor remembered. I would have gone and blabbed to somebody and got in trouble. But if you have these aforementioned powers, perhaps you can implant into one's mind a sort of a psychic seed or subliminal suggestion, perhaps reinforcing tendencies or interests like mine and UFO is already present, that over a lifetime would lead to major alterations in consciousness, either for good or for ill. And if I sound like this is rehearsed, that's because I've obsessed over this for so long.
No, it sounds like you've thought about this a lot. I mean, this is obviously something that you've been living with,
yeah.
and have thought about and thought through thoroughly. And I'm sure a lot of that was because you were writing it down. Because usually if you have an experience that you can't put together, like you said, what's it mean? If you write it out or if you explain it to somebody, then you know, bam, it becomes clear not only, you know, to you, but also to the person.
And any situation, too. I mean, Doug, you are very aware of some of the weird stuff that's happened to me, and what's the first thing I run to? I've written volumes on strange stuff that's happened
write
to me.
It down.
To try to put it into perspective.
So it sounds like you're very, you know, comfortable with the way that it happened and that kind of thing. You're still searching for answers, but I would think that first of all, you mentioned John Keel, which is very interesting because he mixed in with the Mothman stuff that he wrote about was Derenberger, mm-hmm. and we had listened to the Derenberger interviews, and he describes a blonde-haired guy in an alien encounter, a blonde-haired guy who looked exactly normal, just like everybody else. The only thing is, he never moved his lips when he spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And it sound and there's a parallel here because you're saying they're either human or humanoid, right?
Yeah.
And it sounds like the same thing as what Derenberger was trying to describe. So it's really interesting that should come up right now. I mean, talk about synchronicity. Sorry, Ben. Continue on. We were...
Yeah. Well, anyway, I made my way back to the... what happened? Actually, the next thing I knew, I was walking back toward the tents. I mean, again, there was no transition. One moment, it seemed I was being communicated with, facing the fence and facing these entities. The next moment, I'm heading back toward the tents with, again, no sense of transition. And I'm beginning to return to what passes for my normal state of consciousness. And I look back over my shoulder, and there was a fence, but I couldn't see any people. I couldn't see anything, just the fence and the trees and that sort of thing. And I made my way back to my tent, and there was a patch of burrs, spiny-seeded plants, between me and the tent. I threw my thick sleeping bag on them, walked on it, picked it up, threw it on a cot, crawled in, and incredibly went right to sleep. Next morning, there were dirt and burrs adhering to the outside of the bag, proof, at least to my satisfaction, that I had physically been out there. Now, I want to say this. that if this is all that had happened, it would have been very, very hard to explain away in what people like to call rational terms. And when they say rational, what they really mean is conventional. It would be hard to explain it away, but not impossible. And I would be very dubious of my own experience, so I wouldn't be talking to you here now. It was what happened later. It was the aftermath that makes my case different. Because 8 years later, I went to New Mexico State University. I'd been there for a while. I came back from my junior year, fall semester in 63. Our Air Force ROTC attachment had a new senior instructor, Air Force Major Francis Cunyon, wearing a paratrooper badge, an Army paratrooper badge, on his Air Force uniform. And he explained that back in the early 50s, and I think now it had to have been 1953 because he had a Korean tour, he joined this little spec ops unit whose members, he said, were trained to parachute onto crashed Soviet aircraft to gather intelligence should any crash in North America, which apparently they never did.
Right.
And I was young and naive, and I believed him. But this is the unit that author and researcher Kevin Randall, in a magazine article and later in a book, and I read the book and seen his photocopies of Freedom of Information Act documents, clearly proving this was a UFO crash retrieval team. The aircraft story was either a cover story or a dual mission, probably a cover story. So to recap, I had this abduction or encounter experience, tell no one, and one of the first members, one of the leaders, not the top leader, but a subordinate officer of the Air Force's UFO crash retrieval team is appointed directly over me. And I will suggest that we've already pushed the bounds of coincidence out of bounds, and I haven't even gotten to the scary part. I haven't gotten to the bad part.
Yeah, this is sounding very, very synchronistic. I mean, these are the kinds of things that I look for in my everyday life, but that you don't know to look for until they all add up.
Yeah, and right. You start to see the pattern.
And this is starting to add up to a much bigger story, yes.
Well, anyway, various odd things began happening to me at that point. I didn't tie them to Cunyon, and I won't bore you with the details or in the book, except that I did go for a routine pre-commissioning physical at a Holloman Air Force Base in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and I have a little missing time there. Now, I don't want to make too much of that because, you know, it's been many, many decades. I'm an old man now, and who remembers routine physicals? But Holloman has a pretty sinister reputation. There are a lot of stories, including stories about being taken that year, 64, taken away on UFOs. Some of these are almost certainly hoaxes or disinformation, but I'm still a little disturbed by the whole thing because I remember the conversation in the car going to the physical. I remember driving in the front gate of Holloman and then bang, just a blank. So I don't know. I don't know whether that adds up to anything or not. But I went on into the Air Force, and I became an intelligence officer in NORAD, and as an additional duty, because, you know, it was taken out of intelligence by a regulation change from Air Force Reg 202 to Air Force Reg 8017, but as an additional duty, being a junior officer, I got a lot of those. I was a UFO investigator. And back in those days, I tended to believe in nuts and bolts, alien spacecraft, UFOs, so I was pretty interested in the job.
Right.
And years later, I was getting out of the Air Force, because strange and unpleasant things kept happening to me, and I couldn't figure out why, what was behind them. So I very reluctantly decided I would have to leave the Air Force, where I'd hoped to make a career, and I still had some lingering faith in government, so before getting out, I applied by letter.
I'm sorry, but that is a fabulous quote.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah. No more.
All right, continue.
Sorry about that.
We didn't mean to burst, but that was, wow, that was beautiful.
Well, I applied by letter for a job as a civilian intelligence analyst with the DIA, or Defense Intelligence Agency, and they just ignored my letter, never heard from him, but hired another young junior officer at that time who was less qualified for this particular job, although he was a fine man, less qualified than I was by security clearance and background. And I thought that was a little strange, especially since I knew the guy. He didn't have an uncle working there or any connections. And then right after that, I applied with the CIA as an analyst. There was a recruiter in town. I actually hit it off with this guy for once in my life, made a good impression. Excuse me. And he said, of course, he couldn't guarantee anything, but he was recommending me for the job. I was highly qualified. Of course, I had a top-secret clearance and an intelligence background. And normally they're going to follow the recruiter's recommendation. That's why he's there, and they have multiple positions to fill. The next day I get a telegram from Langley, Virginia, CIA headquarters, saying, we're not going to hire you. No reason given. And then the recruiter called me back.
Sounds like my job.
Excuse me. The recruiter called me and said, why haven't I heard from you? And I told him about the telegram, and he said, oh, and that was the end of it. They hadn't even told their own recruiter. Now, if you stop and think about this, as I was forced to do because it happened to me, you realize they don't do that. They're going to let the recruiter go out and make all his recommendations. If they have, say, five positions to fill, they're going to wait till he has, say, 10 recommendations or whatever, and then they'll pick the top five. But they're going to let him finish his recruiting run, and they're going to take his advice. They're not going to just immediately say, we're not going to hire this guy, unless they had a file on me. And I realized at that point that it was like my worst paranoid nightmare come true. They had to have had some kind of file on me. And I thought, but my God, I'm nothing. I'm nobody. I'm a little schmeal of a loser of a guy. How could they have even heard of me? And then, of course, that brought the DI thing back into focus. I realized there was a connection here. And I thought, well, I've got to put this behind me and get on with my life. And it wasn't much of a life. I was in grad school. I couldn't get a teaching job. I finally got a job with the Federal Government Social Security Administration. Because back then they had a test for civil service, and I'm good at taking tests and passing them. And I'd been with them for a while. And I transferred into the old Sacramento, California downtown district office. It no longer exists. Been there a little while, and they transferred in over me, just as Major Cunyon had transferred in over me at New Mexico State. I was there first, then him. Leaving open the possibility that he came there partly because of me. They're transferred in over me this generic management muckamuck on Roland F. Clements, or F. Clements. I think he's still alive and retired, living in Sacramento, I think. Anyway, Clements was a strange man, a member of one of those bizarre 70s cults, Werner Erhard's EST cult, an avid reader of science fiction, and he was regarded as management's hatchet man. One day he called me, my supervisor and union rep, into a conference room in the Social Security office, threw a bunch of papers down in front of me and said, look what you've done. You've illegally altered these Social Security applications over the applicant's signatures without having them approve it by initialing it. And you can be fired and go to prison for this. But when I looked at the photocopies, I saw that in every case, the handwriting, it was so obvious and blatant, it jumped out at me, and my union rep saw it right away. The handwriting was not the client's and not mine. It was not my handwriting. Someone else had altered these things illegally, and Clemens was trying to railroad me into prison on these illegally altered documents. And we forced them to take that out of my file. But I was deeply shocked that that would happen at all. The union had never heard of such a thing. It was just incredible that they would try something like that.
Yeah, that's...
They never did try to catch the person who really did it. Maybe even it was Clements or somebody under his instructions, though they doubted. Well, shortly after this incident, I hadn't recovered from the shock of this, a friend of mine in the office said that Clements had bragged to him of having been a paratrooper. And my friend told me, and Clements verified, he admitted to me, that Clements, the guy who tried to do this to me, had once been in a little tiny Air Force Spec Ops parachute-qualified unit trained to parachute under crash aircraft. Now, this unit, I've talked to any number of ex-retired Air Force personnel. They've never even heard of it. It was so small. Randall, the author, Kevin Randall, estimates it never had more than about 130 people in it. U.S. population.
And yet this thing, you've run now into two. Of them.
Two of them that I know of.
You know what, though, Ben? We have to take a break, but I want to process some of the story in my head, and I'm sure other people do.
Okay, I'll be standing by.
And I want to think about, of course, the book. I wish I had a link to somewhere on the web.
We'll work something out.
Oh, okay, good. Because
we have people for that.
Because I want to link something up on our website to where they can find information about your book.
Hey, I got the Atlantic Monthly with his article in it.
Oh, there we go. That'll work.
Yeah,
but
it's in my bag.
But Ben, you know, on the breaks we play independent music. These are people getting together in their garages.
Ben got a good taste of it last.
Yes, in their basements. They're putting together music, and they want it out there. They want people to listen to it. So, Ghostly Talk, being an independent show, provides a wonderful place, a showcase for independent music, and so that's why we have to go to break. We've got to give these people a chance. So that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to go to break. We'll be back with more from Ben Stecker regarding the Atlantis conspiracy.
Ghostly Talk!
Please note, this article written by Scott L. of Ghostly Talk in 2004 was intended for satirical and entertainment purposes only within the paranormal community.
Welcome to Scott L.'s Guide to Conducting Your Very Own Ghost Tour.
Okay, Once you have solidified the personnel within your ghost hunting group by keeping one together for more than a week, you are going to need to find a means to generate income in order to finance your operations. Ghost hunting is an expensive hobby, and it gets even more expensive when you promise t-shirts to your group with the club's sterling silver-laced logo on the back, with each member's name sewn on the front of them with real purebred stallion horsehair, for example. A real profitable and reliable method to generate income for your ghost hunting group will be to take one of the theoretically haunted highway rest stops, public bathrooms, mobile homes, or topless bars that you have investigated for paranormal activity, and for a small fee, take the, what we call in the business, people who don't know squat on a tour of the area. This will help you accomplish three things. Make you an easy ton of money. Increase your spending power in the paranormal community. And most importantly, raise your paranormal profit margin with the most minimal effort possible. There are other positives less sophisticated people have noted, like learning stuff on these tours and collecting evidence. But who is here to learn anyway, right? 1. The first thing you are going to need to do is pick the most haunted area that you know of to have your tours. That could be a tough decision, though, so I suggest talking it out with your group members to get their opinion.
Where should we have the ghost tour?
How about the Indian burial ground up the road that you pissed on while you were reciting lines from the Necronomicon last week?
Shut up! Did I ask you to talk?
How about at the old abandoned barn where you tried to that ugly crackhorn from the bar the other night?
I don't remember asking for your opinion. I got it. We'll use the old cemetery. You know, the one next to the nuclear energy plant, a couple miles down the road. It's really close. Those biohazard signs they posted up all over the place. They're BS anyways.
Good work. You got over the tallest hurdle. The next thing you will need to do is develop a pricing plan for your tour. There are a few things to figure into this, so take your time with it. Here are a few examples of things you will need to take into account. A. Gas for your mom's van to transport all of your guests from the rendezvous to the haunted area. Seeing that the place that you picked out in this situation is only a couple miles away, we can say at a price of 35 cents a mile, you will be blowing around $1.40 on each ghost tour round trip. B. It would be smart to purchase a small hazard insurance policy for the safety of your patrons, but it would be cheaper to just bury them out there if they get hurt or killed, so forget it. C. Most ghost tours have hot chocolate and cookies before and after the tour, but you found a good deal on Slim Jims and were able to secure a metric ton of them for only 50 cents. So let's break this down, shall we? $1.40 per round trip for gas, $0 for hazard insurance, and finally, just to get some numbers going, a little math if I may. 50 cents divided by 1 metric ton, which equals 2,200 pounds, equals 2.3 pieces of Slim Jim per tour for the patrons to fight over at an assigned, and I stress the word assigned, value of 3 cents. That totals out to $1.43 per trip, with the standard markup of 2,500%, would equal to $35.75 per person per tour. There you go. Wasn't that easy? 2. The next thing you need to do is put together a good promotions campaign in order to attract attention to your little one-night adventures. There are a variety of ways you can advertise, such as buying ad space in publications like the Phenomena News, or the world-renowned, groundbreaking, brilliant, awe-inspiring, arousing, genius, mind-numbing, and worshipped paranormal talk show called Ghostly Talk. The guys from Ghostly Talk are total suckers, too. They advertise tons of stuff free of charge on their site, all for the reason of, get this, helping the paranormal community. So obviously, you're better off finding suckers like Ghostly Talk, whether you have to threaten them with public sodomizing for advertising space or not, because advertising space can be quite expensive. And seeing that you've already maxed out your mom's credit card, pawned everything your pregnant girlfriend owns, and have borrowed to the hilt from the members of your group, your options are limited. 3. Once you have executed the proper exploitation of your little event, you should have patrons lining up for miles. Your inbox should be over quota with PayPal donations. The local news station should be out in front of your house wanting an exclusive. Your snail mail should be delivered every day in a flatbed truck with envelopes stuffed full of checks and cash. Now, here is the part where you can just say forget it, run with all the money to some crack house, party all the money you made away for the next 2 weeks, and then go into hiding for the next year, which is likely. But let's just say you do not do that and decide to fulfill your obligation that you are responsible for.
Put together small groups of people who sent in money of about 40 to 50 to meet at the rendezvous of your choice.
Yeah, a number that will be easy to communicate with and control in a dark cemetery with no lighting whatsoever. Pile them into your mom's van, and when it gets too full, squeeze the remaining few patrons in with a plunger. After that, throw the 2.3 Slim Jims in once all the patrons are seated, or at least not screaming anymore. Once you arrive at the destination, inform your guest that you are there. There are a few rules that you should inform your guest of before you begin the tour. No punching, no biting, no kicking, and of course, no hallucinogenic drug consumption, at least until everyone gets back to the rendezvous. Make sure to point out spots as you walk through the area where violent and horrific atrocities have happened, real or not. For example,
this tree right in front of us is where Duncan Lyletta hung himself. He was in the midst of an intense autoerotic asphyxiation episode, and the chair slipped. His ghost is said to have been seen in front of this tree from time to time, humping it.
That should give everyone the heebie-jeebies to the point of wetting themselves, and then your job is easy. Now all your job is stopping every couple of minutes of the tour and saying, "Did you hear that?" Or, "Did you see that?" Or, "I feel sick." After about a half an hour of this, pretty much everyone will be out for your mom's van chain smoking and telling each other that they felt like something went through them on the tour in between taking hits from the community joint. If the cops have not shown up by now, you may want to squeeze everyone back into your mom's van because a neighbor close by is probably calling the police to tell them they smell marijuana coming from the cemetery next to their house as we speak. Drive everyone back to their rendezvous and blow them off, even if they have pertinent questions concerning the tour, by informing them that last call at your favorite bar is in 10 minutes. Hope you enjoyed the tour!
The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. Therefore, television is reality. And reality is less than television.
Thankfully, the studio is staying nice and cool tonight.
Oh, it's very nice in here. And it's a good thing, too, because...
It's heating up, baby. It's heating up here.
No, it's a good thing, too, because we've got... it's a wonderful... we're learning about Ben Stecker,
yeah,
of course. And
Atlantis Conspiracy.
The Atlantis Conspiracy.
And some nights it's we swelter in this studio.
Sometimes all we want to do is get away.
Yeah,
but right now, I just want to sit here and listen to Ben.
Exactly.
So, what we've talked about so far, Ben, was an interesting experience out at a camping venue when you were 11, and then a couple of interesting things out of a small group of Air Force pilots you happen to encounter in a strange way two of them, which just seems so like the odds you should buy a lotto ticket. You know, the odds of this are just insane. And of course these are you know, bad things are going on through this, and it's just Ben, I'm trying to wrap my head around it, and I'm seeing connections, and I'm drawing lines, and it just seems like, wow, it was out to get you. Something was out to get you, and
yeah.
I don't understand why, because like you said earlier, you're just a normal guy going through life. You had these interests, but it wasn't your, you know, your job or anything. It just didn't. It doesn't line up yet, and I can't see why anyone would pick on you.
Well, I think I finally figured it out. Well, what happened was, like I was saying, when Roland Clements admitted to me that he'd been in that unit,
right,
I instantly realized that the odds of that being coincidence were practically zero.
Yeah,
that I had been targeted, and that business of the CIA and DIA years earlier was a part of it. It's like your worst paranoid nightmare has come true. It's like your life is a cross between a bad spy movie and a bad sci-fi movie, and you're not even the hero. And I thought, well, what about me would make a little nobody like me worthy of this unwanted attention? And I looked back at my life, and the only thing that made me stand out was that encounter experience at age 11. And for the first time, I realized that it did in many ways resemble accounts of UFO abductions.
Yeah.
And then I realized that a unit trained and equipped to parachute on the aircraft would be ideally suited to parachuting on the crashed UFOs if such existed, and the aircraft thing would be a perfect cover story. But how did they know about my abduction? I never told anyone. This was horribly frustrating. I mean, I can be really stupid. It took me a while to figure this out. I think it was at least a couple of years of horrible frustration. And you're so alone when something like that happens. You can't talk to anyone about it. And I finally began to figure it out, I think. They didn't have to know about my specific abduction. Contrary to what some recent authors have said lately, I think that UFO abductions probably almost always run in families or bloodlines.
Oh, interesting.
And all the elite had to do, although that's a pretty big job, is track the families, track the bloodlines, and spy on these people, including people like me, and keep them out of certain government jobs. And I've evolved a theory, which I feel pretty strongly about, that in a normal sleep-wake cycle, we go, of course, into what we call being awake or down asleep. But some people, in fact, everyone on occasions, kind of slips, you might say, sideways in consciousness. And you perceive reality from a different angle. It's not a higher state of consciousness, but it's a different one. And when you put it together with our normal consciousness, you are getting a bigger picture. And in this altered state, that we perceive this paranormal side of reality, and we are perceived in turn by its denizens, for good and for ill. And I've evolved a theory that this tendency is much more pronounced and common in certain bloodlines. In fact, I think there's more to genetics than the physical DNA. I think there's a spiritual component to inheritance as well, or a psychic component. And so the government would be obsessed with keeping these bloodlines out of certain jobs. You consider them dangerous. And you wonder, why would Social Security be such a job? You'd have to read my book for all the details, but the Social Security Administration is not what it pretends to be. It's something a little bit different. In any event, I concluded that the elites themselves, who appear to belong to certain bloodlines, and this, you know, a lot of people have noticed this and pointed it out, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Bushes, and so on, intermarried, interlocking bloodlines, they also, I believe, have this psychic potential, but they have, to use Star Wars terminology, gone over to the dark side of the Force. They are in contact with demonic entities whom they regard as their servants or allies in their attempt to dominate the world. And they consider people like myself to be a potential threat, either potentially useful to them or potentially a threat to be eliminated, which is why I won't say I live in fear, but I'm pretty alert. And once I concluded this, I began trying to tell people about it, to local MUFON people, for example, and I wrote the Air Force Reserve Records Center at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama late in 92 asking about the unit. Incredibly, they said they had no record of such a unit. Well, now, it existed for decades. It probably still does. You don't lose all record of a unit. They were trying to classify the very existence of this unit, and yet during the depths of the Cold War, Major Cunyon and Roland Clements at least admitted that the unit existed. They lied about its mission, but they admitted it existed and they were in it. So why try to classify it when the Cold War is over unless the real mission had nothing to do with the Cold War or Soviet aircraft, but a secret transcending the Cold War? Which, again, brings us back to that same thing. Well, early in 93, I wrote a letter to the editor of UFO Magazine in Southern California, to Don and Vicki Ecker, detailing my experiences, including a copy of my military discharge. Not only did they not publish the letter, Don and Vicki actually called me on the phone and interrogated me at great length. And then shortly after that, Kevin Randall published his article, saying in his article what I've been trying to tell people all along. And so I called him back and left a message. You know, I said, if I'm nuts or hallucinating or whatever, how did I know about this unit? So you guys still there? I can hear you.
I'm
just making sure because I don't trust my phone altogether.
We're listening intently.
Yes,
well, I got just a little more. And
Oh, okay.
Anyway, some years after that, our speaker at a local MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, mm-hmm. meeting in Sacramento, California, was a lady named Melinda Leslie. Now, she'd never heard of me. I got no publicity. I was telling my story years before she came on the scene. Neither one of us could have copied the other. Yes, she said that she had an abduction by whatever they are, these entities, and then not only did the government know about it, but the government actually abducted her for medical experiments. And another lady, Leah Haley, has told the same story, and a number of other women as well. And my whole point is, you know, why would I and these women all come up with a basically similar story? I mean, it's such a stupid story when you think about it. I mean, if I were going to do a hoax, I could do better than that. You don't think how dumb that sounds. And yet we are telling the same story because it happened to us. And the only explanation I've been able to come up with is the one that I just gave you, that they are tracking the bloodlines. So that is what finally led to my writing the book, that more than any other single factor.
Well, it is interesting in that, you know, bloodlines are all important. I mean, we all recognize that medical science says that certain conditions follow in families,
mm-hmm.
right? We know this. It's like, oh, well, did his father or grandfather or whatever have it? Well, you know, obviously, you know, there you go. High blood pressure in your family or whatever, you know. And so we know about the medical side or the physical side. The spiritual side, we've heard literally since the days of yore and yonder and that kind of thing for centuries and centuries.
The days the oceans were created.
Yeah, these stories passed down, you know, seventh son of the seventh son, or the families of witches and things like that. Her grandmother was, you know, able to cure people with a cotton ball and an herb, you know, or something mm-hmm. like that. And you know, whereas nobody else could, you know, use that and cure somebody. It just, you know, you do hear these kinds of things in that, and that's more of the spiritual side.
Yes.
Which is what you're saying, Ben. You're saying that all of this, there is a physical side, yes, and that's what everybody seems to look at and touch and analyze and put our instruments on, right? But there's also a spiritual side, and you've successfully brought them both together here. And in that, although you talked mostly about the story, I can see the threads. So it does put those together, and perhaps that's why they were watching you so close, even though you didn't feel special at all. I don't know.
Ben?
I'm confused. I was just trying to, you know, tell you what I saw in your story and how it makes sense to me. But I was wondering... I'm sorry.
All right.
I was wondering, what other things...
Pull that line out, Doug, and see what happens.
I don't know if I can.
Well, no, and
What did you see in that story? Because I find the premise for this to be extremely believable.
Yeah, of course.
You know, Ben, a lot of people have had...
Look,
UFO abduction experiences, right? I mean, a lot of them. I hear reports every day. And mm-hmm. and heck, Tom is with MUFON.
Yeah,
and he goes and he talks to people who've
yeah.
seen them. I don't know if he's actually done a UFO abduction case yet, but I mean, he will eventually because I talk to people who've gotten that.
Yeah.
What it you know? So this, it's a common occurrence.
Yeah.
Why couldn't a certain subclass of them be also attached to something governmental? The government is
okay. We know of all these, we hear about all these families all the time, all
yes.
the big, huge families, and this is what I'm thinking, the first thing that popped in my head was just that, you know, the Rockefellers and all these huge families, you know, and there seems to be these bloodlines out there that they pretty much, let's be frank, they run the world.
Yeah.
They won't tell you that, oh, we're just oil people, we just mine oil all day long, and we're just good old boys, just like you, right? Mm-hmm. But these people are harvesting piles and piles of cash, right? Which, as we know, in this, unfortunately, in this world, That's
happens.
What runs it. Okay?
That
that's what runs
that's
it.
What's going
runs
on.
On money. And when you have that, you have power. Who isn't to say that there is a relation or correlation like that where, you know, these people may be, that maybe that's the reason they are in the power, you know, the positions that they are.
But what's to gain? I mean, Ben, you don't sound like you want to have power or infinite wealth like the, you know, Bilderberg families. You sound like a normal, level-headed fellow that has all these weird coincidences. So what is there to gain? You know, I don't see why they would keep certain families down. Not yet. I mean, that doesn't mean that that there isn't a reason. That just means I don't understand it yet.
Like the Lamberts are certainly not running anything nowadays.
Neither are the Semics.
Yeah. I don't think the Hammonds are either. Are they, Amber?
Yeah, they are.
Oh, were they running?
Oh, they are? Okay.
Burger King. Okay. Why? Ooh, I'm going to get hit.
I don't know. See, Ben, your story already... Yeah. Already,
okay,
you're
doing, I can barely hear you. I'm worried about the phone still. I can hear you, but not very clearly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll try to speak. But your story, what you've told us today has inspired us to already start talking and analyzing and getting into it. And that's what I really like. So I have to say thank you, first of all, for your story. What an amazing thing. When did you write Atlantis Conspiracy?
I wrote the book in the year 2000, and I published it through POD, you know, Print mm-hmm. on Demand Publishing.
Yeah.
And you know what that is? They just put your story on a disc, and then if somebody orders it, then they print it. So it's a cheaper way of self-publishing. And it's published with a place called Buy.
Mm-hmm.
buybooksontheweb.com, one word, buybooksontheweb, and buy is B-U-Y, buybooksontheweb.com, and then incredibly I have a second publisher called Hidden Mysteries, one word, hiddenmysteries.com.
I like that one better.
Yes, I like that one better too. because the thing is, we've talked with you for what, maybe 30, 40 minutes, right? Ben, and already, I don't know, you said you couldn't hear it very well because the phone line is acting, you know, soft today. But already, Scott and I were just bantering back and forth about what this kind of stuff could mean to the world. Because obviously everything means something and everything is related.
Well, you know what gets me is I'm not a great original thinker or anything like that. But I think through sheer bad luck, because of the things that happened to me and the terrible experiences I've had, that I stumbled upon a very important clue to what's going on. It's like my piece of the puzzle or my brick in the wall. And I'm not giving the whole wall or the whole puzzle, but every piece and every brick are needed. And I stumbled on this clue, and until recently, hardly anyone listened. It seemed like I paid a terrible price for this knowledge. I went through a terrible ordeal with the government, what they did to me. I came close to a nervous breakdown, and my physical health is not the same. And I think this is an important clue that people could take and use and develop further.
And I agree. I think it's more evidence of, you know, because every so often they'll come out with something about UFOs and UFO abductions and what that means to people. And every so often I think, well, you know, it's just not that big of a deal, right? I mean, you know, some people are being, you know, analyzed by scientists from other worlds or whatever's happening, right? And I just think, you know, it's not that big of a deal. I can't do anything about it. I don't know enough about it to help. So I'm just going to let it go and give it to the universe. But then something else will happen, like this, where you told me your story, and this means something where UFO abductions or these kinds of interesting experiences are meaningful to everyday people in everyday lives. It's not just, you know, the people who were chosen to be, you know, ridiculously wealthy, or the people who are at Harvard and studying to cure cancer, or the people who are, you know, it's not like these names that you'll read about in history. It's normal everyday people. Their lives are affected by this, and yours was affected in it basically kept you down. You couldn't get the career that you wanted. It's the effects of your story. I really need to wrap my head around and think about and accept into my worldview. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's going to take some time. And that's why I'm glad you found Atlantis...
The Atlantis Conspiracy.
The Atlantis Conspiracy.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
You're
slowly fading away. I think the problem is probably the battery in my phone.
Oh, no.
That could be.
I barely hear you now. We are almost done, I think.
Yes, we are. Scott, I just want to say this. Scott did find the link to the book, and we're going to put it on the website.
Yeah, so we'll definitely put that on the website for you.
Why don't we take it from here.
If your phone's shooting out, we don't want to try to keep going if your phone's shot, Ben. So we'll talk to you later on, Ben. Thanks for joining us, and we really appreciate talking to you, Ben.
Okay, thank you, guys.
We'll talk to you
soon.
Thank
you
so
much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
That was kind of weird.
Yeah, but
I know it was his phone.
It had to have been because I asked many questions and then I didn't know that it was fading out like that. However, I know it's not your topic, is it?
No,
not at all. And I feel so bad. You had to sit for an hour, but while we're waiting for Bonnie, I highly doubt Bonnie will end up coming tonight.
No way, it's already 8.
It's already 8. I think that she made the call at some point that it was taking too long to fix her car.
All right, what's going on here?
We're talking about Bonnie and how we had. This is not Amber's topic at all.
Why?
UFOs, aliens.
Oh, she hates it.
She absolutely. It's not that she hates it. She just. Are you deathly afraid of it, or it's just like...
Yeah, it's interesting, but it's terrifying.
Yes, exactly. It's terrifying.
Well, sorry, we usually run out to the end of the segment here, but yeah, Ben's phone was taking a dump on him, so obviously you guys could hear it. We were kind of like, okay.
Well, the last thing...
Doug has a brilliant statement he puts out there, and...
It wasn't brilliant. It was kind of fishing and leading.
Right, but it wasn't it wasn't Ben's fault either. There's something wrong with his phone, obviously.
I was trying to engage her in conversation, but unfortunately, when his phone was dying, it...
Yeah.
It didn't.
And that's a purely
up.
Technical thing. We can't change that. We can't deal with that. But, hopefully you guys got something out of that, though. I think it was fascinating myself. I mean, and Doug, you handled it very well.
And you found the link to the book, which
is
fantastic.
Yeah, and I'm going to put it up on the website for people tonight when we do our usual thing, the usual update and whatnot. You guys will have the link if you want to check out the book and all that cool stuff.
Yeah. So that was the Atlantis Conspiracy by Ben Stecker.
Yeah, let's check that out for sure. Coming up, though, what do we got coming up, Doug? What's going on here?
Oh!
Huge,
huge, huge news. Of course, we've got John Anthony West coming back to Ghostly Talk.
It's been a very long time.
Been too long.
Been too long since we talked to this guy, and I am super, super geeked. Little history I have to say, because we have to go to break like now, but this is the gentleman who worked with Dr. Robert Schock, who we've had on the show several times about the redating of the Sphinx.
Yeah.
And speaking about upsetting people. You want to do it? Redate the Sphinx.
That would tick off tons and tons and tons of people.
We'll be talking to John Anthony West right after this, when I turn up the volume now. There we go.
Good idea.